Online at wardenmartin.com. The phone number is 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the U of I Office of the Chancellor, supporting the Campus Charitable Fund Drive. Each year, contributions from U of I employees on the Urbana-Champaign campus help support 11 social service agencies and other nonprofit organizations. Information on how to give and how your donations will help our community is on the web at www.ccfd.uiuc.edu.
The Grasshoppers Dance to get us started this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Most of the Earth's animals are small. More than 90% of the planet's known species are smaller than your fingernail. We are giants. Those are a couple of the first things you will learn when you open the book, The Smaller Majority. Something else that you will realize right from the get-go is the amazing beauty and diversity of the world's tiniest creatures. The book, The Smaller Majority, is the work of biologist Peter Nuskrecki. He is director of the Invertebrate Diversity Initiative of Conservation International and research associate with the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard University. Peter Nuskrecki has traveled to tropical forests, savannas, and deserts across the globe in order to describe and photograph species we will probably never see face to face, but which are essential to the health of our planet. The photos in the Smaller Majority are spectacular. And for a peek at some of the images, you can go to the publisher's website, www.hup.harvard.edu. The book is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. And this afternoon, with Peter Nuskrecki as our guide, we will take a radio armchair expedition into the world of the Smaller Majority. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Peter, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's great to be here.
There is a photo of you in the book taken by your father. You're a boy, and you have two animal friends with you. Are they salamanders?
No, these are actually lizards.
Lizards,
they are common,
okay.
Grass lizards that are quite common in Europe where I grew up.
Yeah. And so growing up, you were able to hold on to your curiosity about grass lizards and about what many people think of as creepy crawlies.
Well, yes, I was extremely fortunate to be able to grow up in an environment that fostered this my love of small animals. My father, who was an astronomer, didn't exactly have a biological training, but nonetheless, he really, really encouraged me to grow more and more interested in the natural world. So from my earliest years, I grew up surrounded by the smaller majority, by these small animals that dominate this world.
Yeah. When did you make your first trip into a tropical rainforest?
Not until I was in my, I believe, very early 20s, probably 21, 22. I went on a trip to Southeast Asia with a friend, and we went to Thailand and Malaysia and Singapore, and that was my first encounter with the splendor of the tropical rainforest, and that left on me an incredible impression that pretty much shaped the rest of my life.
Yeah. Is there any one thing you remember most vividly about that first trip?
The absolutely overwhelming richness of life. I tried to remember everything I saw or photograph everything I saw. And that very quickly became completely overwhelming. And I had this experience, this unbelievable sensory exhaustion that left me kind of tired. And I had to sort of sit down on the beach and process what I have seen so far. And only then I was able to go back into the rainforest and do it sort of more calmly. That was an incredible experience.
Yeah. Well, given the photographs that are in the smaller majority, number one, your sense of sight must be overwhelmed. And then there must be all kinds of wonderful, rich sounds. And I would imagine also the sense of smell is engaged as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I cannot think of a more pleasant smell than the smell of the rainforest, this oversaturated atmosphere of leaves and flowers and smells that I cannot even name. And of course, yes, the sound of the forest, especially the forest at night, is probably the most pleasant sound, the most pleasant sound atmosphere you can possibly imagine. There are millions of individual insects and frogs and birds that call simultaneously, creating this incredible soundscape. And my fascination with the sounds of the rainforest and other environments is probably one of the main reasons why I work primarily on singing insects. I just absolutely love the sound of it.
Hmm. Now, you've made these wonderful photographs. Have you made recordings?
Oh, yes. I have made a lot of recordings. And my professional career, so to speak, concentrates on singing insects, more specifically on katydids and their relatives. And the sound that they produce is very often used as a tool to identify species. So I always try to record every single species, and I analyze the sound, and the properties of the sound of each katydid tells me something about their biology. It also tells me a lot about their identity.
Mm. That's why you have so many photographs of katydids in the book.
Well, they are also probably the most beautiful animals
they
on
are.
The planet.
They are lovely. They are beautiful. Well, given the numbers of these creatures and the number of species, how do people such as yourself know when you've come across something that is new to science?
Well, in order to know that something is new, you have to know what has already been discovered. And that's not as easy as it sounds, because we have described, this science has described, over 1.7 million species so far of all organisms. That includes plants and mammals and so on. So it's impossible to know every single organism that you encounter. It's impossible to know whether it's new or not. That's why biologists specialize on different groups, and my speciality happens to be insects. But in order to be sure that I have found something that's actually new, I have to look at what's been already described or known from the particular region or from this particular group of insects that I'm studying. So, for example, for the katydids, the first thing that I did when I started working on katydids was to create a catalog of all species that have been discovered so far, and that number of those species approaches 7,000 species. So I had to build this sort of reference database that I have to consult every time I collect in a new region, in a new environment, and compare my findings with what's already known and published. And that's really the only way to go.
Yeah. And how does the process unfold of describing a new species?
Well, it can be quite tricky, especially in a group like katydids. Katydids rely on the sound in their sort of in a communication and sort of maintaining the coherence of species. And very often you will find species of katydids that are very, very similar to each other, and they only differ in their call they produce. And that call is used by the opposite sex to recognize their partners. So there is no sort of incorrect mating between two different species. And so that's why the recording of the sound in the case of katydids is so extremely important. So as an example, I work a lot in Costa Rica, and Costa Rica has quite a number of these what's called cryptic species that look very, very similar but have different calls. So I have to record every single individual, and then I analyze the sound. I analyze the different properties of the recording and compare them to what's already known. And if I find a sound that's very, very different from what has already been described and recorded, then I have an indication that that particular individual may represent a new species. And then I start looking at other characters on very minor morphological characteristics, such as the different details of the wings, different details of various details of the reproductive structures. And we also look at the genetics of these species. We look at the molecular sequences, and that allows us to make a decision whether this particular individual of this particular population represents something new. It's sometimes quite a difficult process unless you find something that's so dramatically different that you know from an instance that it's something new.
Yeah. Now, if you find something that's dramatically different, how do you go about learning how that species makes its living?
I try to spend a lot of time in the environment of that particular species. For example, just this year, I discovered an absolutely amazing katydid in the mountains of Costa Rica at the elevation of nearly 3,000 meters. That's about 9,000 feet. That katydid lives on the forest floor of the what's called the cloud forest, and probably feeds on lichens. So once I found the first individuals of this species, I spent about a week going out every single night and spending many, many hours watching these animals, measuring the parameters of its environment, the optimal temperature when they feed, the plants that they visit. I also try to learn as much as possible about the reproduction of the species in this very short span of time that I had there. So every time I encountered that, I encounter something that I suspect might be new, I basically try to embed myself in its environment and learn as much about its environment and the behavior of the species as possible. But on the other hand, in many, very many cases, we know absolutely nothing about the biology of the new species, because you might be surprised to know that most of discoveries of new species don't happen in the rainforest or savanna or the desert, but they happen among the dusty drawers of museums, natural history museum and biological collection. What very frequently happens, you have an expedition going to some remote tropical location. The researchers bring thousands and thousands of specimens, and then it takes years to analyze them and compare them to the existing knowledge of these particular groups. And, sometimes a new species may be named and properly described a hundred years after its actual physical collection.
Wow. So once a specimen is out of its home, so to speak, and has been in a drawer for 100 years, what isn't that difficult to try and figure out what its home was like? Or
it is very, very difficult in many cases, and even it's actually quite sad, because very often what happens is that somebody collected a katydid or an animal. 100 years later, this animal is recognized as being new to science, and when you try to go and find out its natural habitat, that habitat is already gone. And even more dramatically, the species may already be gone. We already have instances of species of animals that were named and properly described after their actual extinction in the natural habitat. That even happens here in the United States. There is a katydid that was discovered in California. It was discovered in a museum, and when the researcher who found it went back to the original site of the finding, he found a parking lot, and the katydid was gone. So he promptly named this particular katydid Neduba extincta, meaning the extinct katydid, even though it was alive just, you know, a few years earlier.
Yeah. And many katydids, you report, in the smaller majority, are very specialized.
Yes. Katydids, you know, when you have 7,000 species that occur all over the world, you also encounter a lot of specialization among them. A lot of katydids specialize on feeding on particular plants or feeding on particular animals, and they also represent this incredible spectrum of shapes and sizes and colors that allow them to fit perfectly in that particular niche that they inhabit in this particular micro ecosystem. So we have a lot of plant mimics in the katydid world. We have species that are such incredible mimics of plants that I have yet to find one of these things during the day, because when they sit motionlessly during the day, they look absolutely just like a leaf. And the only way to find them is to go out in the middle of the night with a headlamp or a flashlight and look for this telltale movement among leaves that indicates that that leaf is actually feeding on another leaf. And that's how you know that you found a katydid. There are also katydids that are remarkable mimics of moss. Their body is covered with very fine spines and lobes and protuberances that make them blend completely seamlessly into the carpet of mosses that covers almost everything in the rainforest. You have katydids that look like blades of grass. You have even katydids that look like rocks, and they live in the desert in southern Africa. And so the variety of shapes of katydids is really remarkable. When we think of katydids, if you know what a katydid is, you probably think of something green that comes to your porch light at night. But there is much more to a katydid than just that.
How much variety is there among katydids in the United States, in North America?
Quite a lot, actually. Unfortunately, because they are such a superb mimics, a lot of the species are very difficult to find. You very often hear them, but you never know where they are. There's a large group of katydids that are perfect mimics of blades of grass. So if you go out into a meadow sometime in the evening during the summer, you will hear them, this continuous buzzing sound. These are conehead katydids. They're called coneheads because they have a big cone on the head that helps them to resemble a kind of a pointy blade of grass. And these animals are virtually impossible to find. You really have to follow the sound and very, very slowly and patiently stalk it in order to actually discover the insect sitting in a clump of grass. And even when you locate it, even if you are a foot away from it, looking right at it, you will not be able to see it until it moves. Such superb mimics they are. There are katydids that never descend from the canopy of trees. There are several species in the United States that live high in the trees. They complete their entire reproductive cycle there, and you will only encounter them when they get knocked down by a storm or a gust of wind. So there is quite a variation in the katydid fauna in the United States. If you go down south to Arizona or Texas or Southern California, you will find katydids that are adapted to living in the desert, and they will look like kind of dry, shriveled little leaves or shriveled little branches, and they are also very very well camouflaged and difficult to find. And very often, the only way to find them is to trace the call of the katydid. And unfortunately, there is also an additional wrinkle in this, in that a lot of the katydids produce sounds of frequencies that are too high for the human ear to detect. The pitch of the call is in the same range as the call of a bat, which is really, really high. Very few people are capable of hearing bats, and that's why very, very few people will also be able to hear those katydids. When I go out into a new environment, I always carry with me a special little device that sort of translates those high frequencies into a lower frequencies, so I'm actually able to hear it. And it's quite an amazing experience that you walk into an environment that appears to be completely silent. You turn on that little apparatus, and suddenly the whole environment comes alive with calls of many, many different species whose pitch is too high for my ear to discern.
Hmm. That's amazing.
Yes.
You tell readers at the outset of the smaller majority that most of the organisms you photographed for the book would fit inside a matchbox. And now you've told us about how well katydids, for example, camouflage themselves and hide out. So would you talk with us about how you've been able to make such stunning photographs of these animals who are so well suited to avoiding avoiding the limelight?
Right. Well, not all animals try to hide. Quite on the contrary, a lot of animals want to be seen, want to be instantly recognized, and those are the animals that are very well protected by something, be it a chemical defense or, you know, venom glands or something that makes them unpalatable, something that warns a potential predator that some harm will come their way if they try to eat that particular animal. And those are the animals that are usually the most beautiful. They usually have bright colors, very contrasty colors, yellows, blacks, reds, and blues. So those animals are actually very easy to find and photograph. They are also very easy to approach because those animals feel that they have an immunity, and they don't run away.
Yeah.
The problem is, as you mentioned, the finding those that are trying to blend in, and what I feel I have acquired over the years of during all my the time that I've spent in the forest and so on is a sort of a search image for certain irregularities in the pattern in the texture of the forest. The thing about insects and other animals is that they are symmetrical, so they have a left and a right side of the body. So anytime you notice a symmetry in the tapestry of the vegetation, that's my first indication that might be actually an animal and not a plant. That's also the reason why a lot of these animals try to somewhat contort their body to break that symmetry. So a lot of lizards, such as geckos, who are, of course, also perfectly symmetrical, twist their bodies when they are resting on a tree trunk or resting on a leaf to sort of make it more difficult to spot a pattern. But again, with experience comes the ability to see beyond that camouflage and find these animals. But still, I am sure that I have missed thousands and thousands of spectacular animals because they were so perfectly blended in.
Yeah. Well, one of the many beautiful animals that you photographed for the smaller majority is a damselfly, a Sappho ciliate. Found
yes.
in West Africa. Describe that creature for us.
This particular damselfly belongs to a group, into a family of damselflies called Calopterygids. And one remarkable feature of these animals is that they have this absolutely spectacular metallic blue coloration. And males of these species use this coloration to display to their females. They flutter and kind of have these duels in the air, trying to impress the female with this glowing metallic beautiful color. So you have metallic blue and metallic green species, they often inhabit tropical rainforest. Although we actually have very similar species in the United States, I'm sure there are some in Illinois. There are certainly some in Massachusetts where I live, and they are really, really pretty. And unfortunately, they very much depend on natural undisturbed habitats that have natural vegetation surrounding pure bodies of water. So unfortunately, we these are some of the first animals to go if something happens, something negative happens to the environment. And these beautiful, gorgeous, innocent-looking animals are actually vicious predators. They feed on smaller insects. They are very, very good flyers. They have excellent vision, and they can very easily catch in flight flies and mosquitoes and other small insects. And that's why I like them so much, because every time I see a damselfly fluttering around my head when I'm in the rainforest, I know that damselfly is protecting me from mosquitoes. And that's why I really, really like them.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and entomologist Peter Nascrucki is our guest this afternoon. He is the author of The Smaller Majority. He is also director of the Invertebrate Diversity Initiative of Conservation International and research associate with the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard University. Listeners, this is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn, and I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. I welcome your questions and comments for our guest. You can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You know, we've touched on the environment here a couple of times this afternoon in terms of the destruction of habitat, the disappearance of habitat. And early in the book, The Smaller Majority, you say what you're out to do here is to ask us to try and notice and understand invertebrates and other small animals, because, in your words, understanding is a prerequisite to caring, and caring is the key to saving. Maybe at this point you'd offer us an overview of the decline of small animals and why we should care about saving them.
Yes, it's actually quite dramatic. There is a crisis going on in the small world that surrounds us. I'll give you an example of what's happening to frogs, which I also consider the members of the smaller majority. A recently conducted global assessment of amphibian species. It was a program led by the Conservation International and the Survival Species Commission and several other organizations. That survey have found that since 1980, we have already permanently lost 120 species of frogs and salamanders worldwide. And another 100 or so species are probably extinct. We don't have the definite proof, but we think that they are also gone. And also, almost half of known species of frogs and toads and salamanders in the world are threatened with extinction. The reasons for that decline are many. It's more of a death by a thousand cuts rather than a single reason for their disappearance. It's a combination of pollution, climate change, fungal diseases, lower levels of ozones in the atmosphere, and so on. But the cumulative effect of it, which actually can almost in all cases be traced to human activity, is a very, very dramatic decline of the species, of the population of amphibians. And the number one reason for the decline of species of animals and plants in the world, one that's causing an extinction of about 1,000 species a year of the small animals, is of course the habitat loss. We are losing the natural habitats, not just the forests, although that's probably most dramatic, but also natural savannas, natural desert habitats, undisturbed marine habitats. We are losing them at an incredible rate. And with each patch of a forest, with each patch of a savanna, we are losing species that we may not even know yet, where species that may not have been even described by science. The problem with the small animals is that they are small, and thus also their ranges, their distributions tend to be smaller because their dispersal abilities are lower than those of the big animals. So even a seemingly small and unimportant patch of a forest, of a tropical forest, once it's gone, it basically spells the demise of countless little species. Mm. I can give an example of the island of Madagascar. Over 90% of the original forest coverage of Madagascar is gone. We only have very small remaining patches of the natural forest, and with those 90% of the forest coverage gone, we probably have already lost about 50% of what has lived on Madagascar. It's very difficult to put a precise number in terms of species, but we are talking thousands and thousands and thousands of species, and we will never ever know what they were. And why should we care about these little animals? Well, the reasons are many. Let's start with the sort of utilitarian reasons. We depend on these small organisms. They perform ecological services that we take for granted. We don't even realize how much we depend on them. But think about it. Where do the fruit and vegetables come from? Mm-hmm. Well, they come from plants. But something has to pollinate those plants. If it wasn't for pollinator insects, for the bees, for the flies, for the butterflies and moths, we would have no fruit. What happens to all the fallen leaves and you know, dead animals and dead organic matter? It gets recycled. It gets recycled mostly by insects, by ants, termites, flies, beetles, and so on. So they are these great recyclers of the organic material. They take the organic matter and they put it back into this cycle of life on this planet. So they provide nutrients for the new generations of plants. The invertebrates create the soil. The reason why we have productive soils where so many plants can grow is because of the work of earthworms and termites and ants that make the soil rich, mm-hmm. and properly aerated. They allow the oxygen to get into the soil so that the plants can grow properly. When we look at the aquatic environments, the reasons why the rivers and lakes are clean, at least in those areas where there is not too much human pollution, is because we have all these filterers, mussels and clams. These animals constantly filter the water, remove the excess of algae and other and organic debris, and allow other organisms to survive. Also, we have to think about what all these big charismatic animals depend on. Let's take birds. What do the birds eat? Birds primarily eat insects. If it wasn't for insects, there would be no singing birds. So, you know, if something suddenly happened and we lost all the invertebrate animals, all the insects and spiders and so on, then the life on this planet as we know it, we would cease to exist. Because we depend so much on these small organisms, we humans and with us all the big charismatic mammals and birds would go extinct in a matter of months or years. We really, really need those things. One of the examples that I gave in the book is the example of mountain gorillas. These fantastic, spectacular animals that live in the clouds forest of Rwanda. There's a lot of effort put into their protection, and there should be. We really should save those animals. However, if those gorillas were to disappear, the environment as such would hardly notice that disappearance. But if just a single species of savanna termites were to disappear, the entire ecosystem would collapse because those termites make it possible for other animals to live in the savanna. They remove the dead stalks of grass that prevents them from piling up and choking the savanna. They put it back into the soil. They recycle the nutrients in those dead stalks of grass and allow for the new generation mm-hmm. to grow, and the big grazing animals depend on that. So, you know, we may not realize that, and we may not like the small animals, but we really, really need them.
Yeah. Well, in my backyard, there are ants that act as farmers, in a sense. Mm-hmm. They take, I have some wildflowers growing in the backyard, bloodroot, and they take the seeds, and there's something on the seed that they like to eat, apparently. And so they take the seed and they take it underground with them.
Yes. A lot of ants, there's actually a whole class of ants called the harvester ants, and they specialize on seeds. Those little attachments that you see on some seeds have actually evolved specifically for the benefit of the ants. Ants use those little bodies that contain nutritious proteins and fats to feed the larvae. And in exchange for the nutritious substance, they take the seeds, they bury them underground, thus protecting the seed and allowing it to germinate in the really favorable conditions. So a lot of plants depend on ants in their reproduction.
Yeah.
And you know, just like some plants depend, I mean, lots of plants depend on pollinations. The next step is the actual distribution of the seeds, and ants do it very, very well.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to see all the places now where bloodroot crops up in the springtime.
Mm-hmm.
In the yard, the ants have done a very good job by the bloodroot. Why is it that given the importance of these small creatures, that we are so drawn to conservation efforts for larger animals?
Well, I believe there are several reasons for that. Well, first of all, we are drawn to big animals because they are in the same, so to speak, league as us. It's much easier to make an emotional connection with something that's about our size, that we can, that has big eyes we can look into, and it will return our gaze, and it has the same or similar characteristics as us. It's a, you know, big, warm-blooded animal. So it's completely understandable that we feel this kinship with larger animals, animals that are either mammals or birds, that are sort of closer to us. And at the same time, the smaller animals have several disadvantages. Well, one of course is the size. Then there's also the problem that, you know, a lot of these animals have very different physical characteristics than us, and it's difficult to relate to them and make this emotional connection. A lot of these small animals have too many eyes, or have none at all, or you know, their morphology is such that we don't even know where the head is. So it's very difficult to kind of communicate on an emotional level with these animals. And at the same time, as you know, everybody knows, a lot of people are basically repulsed by these little animals, or very much afraid of them, and that's why, you know, it's very difficult to talk about the conservation of something that we're either afraid of or really, really don't like. Mm-hmm. There's also this perception that a lot of these animals are pests and they interfere with our business. That's, again, it's a somewhat a false perception, because in nature, there is no such a thing as pests. We create pests by altering the natural balance of the environment, by creating monocultures or by eliminating natural enemies of certain species, thus causing the population of certain animals to grow over sort of a natural limits and devouring of our crops. So that's why it's so difficult to promote the conservation of these smaller animals, because we sort of cover all of them with the same blanket of things that are they're ugly, disgusting, and harmful. And that's really, really not the case. There are, of course, some species that are in one way or another harmful to the sort of the human business, but that's a very, very, very small proportion. This is it's sort of like, you know, discarding all the mammals, you know, pandas and elephants included, because there are rats. Just because there are a few bad apples in a group, that doesn't mean that the entire group should be condemned. We should make a really, really clear distinction between the majority of small life, which is really, really beneficial, and a few of them that can do some minimal harm to us.
Yeah. One of the animals you photographed is the coconut crab. And this this critter is something. It's pretty frightening looking. It's a relatively large small animal, and you know
this
here
is actually...
this goes to the point where you know it's easier to look at a panda and go oh my, and then you look at a coconut crab and you go oh my.
Yes. Well, this the coconut crab is a remarkable animal for several reasons. It's an exception in this book in the sense that this is probably the largest animal that I photographed. Coconut crab is not just any regular crab. First of all, it's an animal that lives on land. It's a terrestrial crab. So they never go into the sea. It's also the largest invertebrate animal in the world, the largest animal without the internal skeleton. They can reach a leg span of 3 feet and a weight of about 9 pounds. So think about a lobster or something that's about three times as big as a lobster walking in the forest and climbing trees. That's the coconut crab. And coconut crabs, as the name implies, very often feed on coconuts, and they are perfectly capable of opening one of them with their extremely powerful claws. But on the other hand, you know, you mentioned pandas and coconuts and why we like pandas. But think about it. There's not a known case of a coconut crab, let's say, killing a person. But there are known cases of pandas killing a person. The pandas are bears, and they are really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas coconut crabs, they may look scary, but they are pretty much harmless as long as you keep your fingers away from their claws. They won't harm you. Actually, they receive a lot of harm from us. Coconut crabs have been wiped out from a lot of the places where they used to live, which is mostly islands in the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, because they are incredibly tasty. And because they feed on coconuts, their meat is sort of saturated with this coconut flavor. At least that's what I heard. I never had one. And that's why they are over-harvested, and they are already on the put on the red list of species that should be protected. They are threatened with extinction, just like pandas.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that. They do look intimidating. How did you get this fellow's photograph? How up close and personal did you get?
I got pretty close and personal to the point that I actually did almost lose a finger. I didn't realize that they might be quite aggressive, and when they first see you, they start waving their big claws and they try to fend you off. They don't really mean to hurt you. They just feel threatened themselves. You know, there's this giant something looming over them, so they quite understandably try to fend you off. But eventually this particular individual got used to me, and I was able to get very, very close. So I followed it for hours, sort of crawling on my belly in this coconut grove in the Solomon Islands. And actually, at some point, I almost got killed by a coconut that fell literally 2 inches from my head as I was lying on the sand taking actually the very photograph that appears in the book. So there is some danger in photographing of coconut crabs, but it doesn't necessarily come from the crab itself.
Yeah. Would you tell us about another close call you've had doing field work?
Sure.
There are many here that I have in front of me. My goodness.
There have been a few. Probably the most potentially frightening was being bitten by a poisonous snake. I got bitten by a viper and had to spend a week in the hospital recovering from the bite. You know, things happen. I mean, I've been keeping a list of all the parasitic diseases and other things that I've contracted over the years, and it's a long list. But I usually don't talk about it because I really consider it a very, very small price to pay for the privilege of being able to see these remarkable animals in their natural habitat and being able to visit these places that, you know, few people are able to go to. So I consider it just a risk that comes with the job, and I'm I'm happy that, you know, I'm still alive and I'm still able to enjoy the forest and deserts and so on.
Yeah, well, take care of yourself.
I'll try.
I am so glad that you are doing it and that you consider the risks to be small potatoes, because it's wonderful to see your work here in this book.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to be doing it, and I hope I'll be doing it as long as I can.
Yeah, well, keep up the good work. Thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon. It's been a pleasure.
It was great talking to you. Thank you.
Peter Neskrecki has been my guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is responsible for the book The Smaller Majority, which is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. And for a peek into the book, into the marvelous imagery and the stories that are contained in The Smaller Majority, well, you can visit the website of the publisher, and that is www.hup.harvard.edu. Our guest this afternoon, entomologist Peter Neskrecki, is director of the Invertebrate Diversity Initiative of Conservation International and research associate with the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard University. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, most important thing that happened at the board today was new contract low being made in the corn pit all the way down in the December contract for the lead option to $1.90 and three quarters. The settlement price was down in that area, too, at $1.91 and a quarter. They were off a penny today. It means that the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade for the corn pit put in an outside down week this week. Technically speaking, that probably won't be good as we go through next week's trade. We'll talk with Chuck Shelby out of West Lafayette, Indiana, and Risk Management Commodities at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock this afternoon about all of the trade, including what happened in the corn pit and the 9-cent drop that happened in the bean pit today. I asked Dave Dickey just exactly what was going on, whether that was bird flu or something else, whether it was technically driven, just coming down with the corn. And he said, hey, take your pick. There's not much going on. So we'll see if Chuck has anything more to say about that. Nonetheless, prices were lower at the Board of Trade, including in the wheat pit December contract, 304.5 the high today, the low at 301.25 for that December contract. In the wheat, 302 the settlement price, they were down 2.75. March futures, 321.5 the high, the low at 317.5, a settlement price at 317.75, down 3.25. And the May wheat, 329.5 the high, the low at 326.75, settlement price at $3.27, they were off 3.5 cents. July futures in the wheat pit, 334.5 on the low for the day, the high at 338, and a settlement price at 335, and they were down 3.25 for the day. September futures, 345, the high, the low at 43, settled on that low at $3.43 for the soft red winter wheat in the September contract, 2006, down 3.5 cents. Now from the corn pit, December contract, your lead option, $1.92 and a quarter, the high, the low, a new contract low at 190 and three quarters, settlement price at 191 and a quarter, put in an outside down week this week, down a penny in the December corn on this Friday afternoon. March futures, 206.5 the high, the low at 205, settlement price just a quarter above that at 205 and a quarter, a penny and a quarter lower. And the May futures in the corn pit, 214 and three quarters the high, the low at 13, settlement price at $2.13 and a quarter cents, they were down a penny and three quarter a bushel. July futures, 222 the high, the low at 221, settled at 21 and a quarter, down three quarters. And September's off three quarters as well, had a high of 231, a low at 229 and three quarters. September's settling down three quarters of a cent at $2.29 and three quarters. And next year's December contract, 241.5 the high, the low at 40.5, settlement price at 240 and three quarters. They were off a half for the day. December oats now, 170.40 the high, and the low at 170.5 the high, the low at $1.67, settlement price at $1.68. They were up three quarters. The March futures up three quarters as well, 178.5 the high, the low at 174.60, and a settlement price at 175 and three quarters. Once again, that contract in the March oats up three quarters for the day. January beans finished like this, 574.5 the high, the low at 569, settlement price at 569 and three quarters. They were down 9.5. March off 9.5, 577 and a quarter, the settlement price there, the low at 77, the high for the March soybeans, 581.5. May futures, 587.5. The high, the low at 582. Settled at 582.75. They were down 9.25. In July beans, a 592.5 high, low at 587.25. Settlement price at $5.88. They were off 9.25 on this Friday afternoon. August futures were down 9.75 at 589.75, with a high at 93.5. The low a quarter of a cent lower than the settlement price at $5.89.5. September futures at 594.5. The high, the low at 589.75. Settlement price at 589.75, down 7.75. And the harvest month for next year, November beans, 598.5. The high, the low at 95. Settled on that low, they were off 8 cents for the day. December bean meal, 173.80. The high, the low at 171.50. Settled $172.20. They were off 260. The January bean meal down $3 even at 173.20. December bean oil down 15, 22.01. The settlement price, the high at 22.08. Settlement price at 22.01 and the low at 21.90. January futures in the bean oil, 22.19 on their last trade for the day. They were off 15 as well. Now, with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange, here's Les Quinn.
Okay, Todd, it was a lower day today for the cattle contracts, while lean hogs and February bellies finished higher. January feeder cattle, the high today 113.85, the low 113.32.5, the settlement 113.60, that down 25. March 111.95, the high 111.35, the low 111.75, the settlement that down 40. April 110.45, the high 110.15, the low 110.35, the settlement that down 20. December live cattle 91.25, the high 90.65, the low 91.02.5, the settlement that down 20. February live cattle 93.92.5, the high 93.45, the low 93.75, the settlement that down 35. December lean hog 62.85, the high 61.90, the low 62.62.5, the settlement that up 52.5. February 66.75, the high 65.95, the low 66.55, the settlement that up 47.5. April 67.95, the high 67.15, the low, the settlement 67.82.5, that up 65. May lean hog 69.50, the high 68.50, the low, finishing at 69.45, up 70. February pork bellies, today's high 89.50, the low 87.10. The settlement today for February bellies 88.52.5, that finishing up 77.5. The Dow is up 9 points at 10,730. The Nasdaq 2 higher at 22.22, and the S&P 500 up 1 at 12.44.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Henry Frayne is our technical director this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, the producer for the program, Harriet Williamson. My name is Celeste Quinn. Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. In northern and central sections, a mix of clouds and sunshine. In the south, sunny. Highs ranging from 35 in northeastern Indiana to 52 in southwestern Illinois. Tonight, mostly clear, lows ranging from 25 in northeastern Indiana to 32 in west central Illinois. Tomorrow, in northwestern and west central Illinois, sunny early, then increasing cloudiness.